Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
And we were interested initially in specific evolutionary debunking arguments. Those, for example, are commonly targeted at religious belief. So you try to explain away why somebody has religious beliefs in terms of its adaptive advantages and draw the conclusion, well, therefore, there's no reason to take the belief seriously. And the well-known arguments of my recently departed colleague Richard Joyce, which take the same approach to morality. Richard argues that a thorough understanding of the evolution of our moral sense should undermine your confidence in the validity of your moral judgments. But we soon got interested in more general evolutionary debunking arguments, and particularly the well-known arguments of Alvin Plantinga. And as many of you will know, Alvin Plantinga, the distinguished theologian at Notre Dame, has argued that... sorry. I didn't mean it like that. just trying to be descriptively accurate. Has argued that for every class of beliefs, coming to believe that those beliefs have been generated by an evolved cognitive faculty should undermine your faith in the validity of those beliefs. Okay, if you think that your beliefs were produced by evolution, you should cease to accept any of them. So we were interested in particularly in the asymmetries between why do some of these arguments look different? Many people who accept one such argument don't accept another such argument, and why. So what I'm going to do today, the paper I distributed to some people earlier on was about this general problem. I want to concentrate very specifically on a general evolutionary debunking argument. What I'm going to do is to, I guess my view is that the kind of move that people like Plantinga have made is made far too easy by some sloppy thinking about the evolution of cognition that's been quite popular with people who would see themselves actually as good scientific naturalists. So I'm actually beginning with a quote from somebody who we would not associate with Alvin Plantinga, namely Steve Stitch. What I want to suggest is that the thought involved there in that quote is deeply and fundamentally confused. So looking at, I'm not going to do justice fully to Stitch here, because Stitch's argument is that understanding the evolution of our inference machinery should undermine our trust in the validity of those inferences. I actually think it doesn't make a big difference whether you talk about the truth of our beliefs or the validity of our truth-preserving validity of our inferences, but I'm not going to confront that Stitch stuff directly. Instead, what I want to do is to sketch what I think is an underlying thought, which is much too frequently admitted to, much too frequently entertained by people of a more naturalistic bent, and try to explain to you why it's not a very good line of thought. And it's the line of thought that I've tried to lay out perhaps as rigorously as one could, but something like this. So you start out with this, which is taken to be somehow truistic. Evolution will favor beliefs that maximize fitness irrespective of whether they're true. And then you move to this idea that hence we should expect cognitive adaptations to be truth tracking only insofar as that's also fitness tracking. Now, in its own terms, you might think that's okay, but when it's phrased in this sort of a way where you suggest there's some kind of choice to be made between selection for reproductive success and selection for truth tracking, that's where I'm going to argue that a certain sort of confusion has arisen. Then you make this point, drawing on the work of, Gigerenzer and Todd's stuff, on standard work on failures of human rationality in psychology. And you say, well, look, there are plausible scenarios in which selection will favor unreliable cognitive systems which produce many false beliefs over more reliable cognitive systems which will eliminate those beliefs. And so then you say, well, look, that shows the fitness tracking doesn't coincide with truth tracking. And sort of sticking this thought together with that thought, you get something like, well, having the view that our minds are the products of evolutionary adaptation should not create a general expectation that our minds are going to track truth. Okay? So you end up with apparently quite respectable mainstream naturalistic philosophers rejecting the common sense view that the evolved purpose of cognition is to generate veridical representations of reality. Okay? I mean, if you ask the average guy in the street what's the evolutionary purpose of having a big brain, they'd say so you can know things and so you can work out how to do the right thing and so on and so forth. Okay? It's about getting it right. And this gives you a reason for somehow regarding that as oversimple or naive or whatever. So what I want to do is to look at two problems. One is, I think, a fundamental misuse of the basic distinction between selection of and selection for. And this will make some contact with Jerry Fodor's recent work, because what I'm going to do is to argue that the distinction between selection of and selection for is entirely unproblematic, but massively misused by philosophers. So what's wrong is not, there's nothing wrong with the distinction. We apply it in contexts in which it's simply inapplicable and meaningless. And we should stop doing that, and then we wouldn't have all these problems. And the second thing I want to do is to argue, as other people have, Michael Ruse amongst others, that involved here is a somewhat inflated conception of what it is to have a true belief. I think that's particularly clear in Plantinga's writing, although I'm not going to do any exegetical work on that. So I'm going to suggest, this is probably the most controversial part of the talk, that we as naturalists ought to have a quite deflated notion of what it is for your beliefs to be true or your judgments to be correct. Which I wonder if that makes any contact with what Alex Rosenberg is going to say tomorrow. We'll have to see whether there's a connection there. Okay, so Peter Godfrey-Smith talked us through this yesterday. I'm not looking at it in quite the same sense. This drawing was used by Sober in a paper and a book in 84 to introduce the distinction between selection for something and selection of something. So in the picture, the argument is you start out with all the balls at the top, you shake the toy and you get the distribution that we see here, and somebody says, this toy selects green balls. And Sober wants to say, well, that's true in the sense that there's selection of green balls, but in fact there's only selection for small balls. So what selection is targeting here is the size, not the color. The selection of color is a side effect of the selection of size, various ideas like that. Now, that idea has been much criticized. The German-American philosopher Peter McLaughlin's argued that, you know, there's no role in biology for the selection of, selection for distinction. Jerry Fodor and many others have argued that there's no determinate thing which is the target of selection. So what I want to do is just to go back and revisit why. Obviously, you don't pick up a copy of Trends in Ecology and Evolution and see selection of, selection for all over the place. You do see it, but it's not a really biological locution. But I want to show you that the idea that Elliot Sober was talking about is a totally common sense idea that you have to use an evolutionary theory, you ought to use an evolutionary theory, and there's no problem with it. The example I want to use is these little guys over here. These, as you probably know, most frogs signal to their conspecifics by making noises. I'm not going to try and do a frog imitation here. And they signal to attract sexual partners, they signal to signal their territory to other frogs and so forth. But there are a large number of frog species all over the world which don't sit around croaking. Instead, when they want to signal to their conspecifics, they raise either one or both of their back legs and spread their feet and send sort of what are often called in the literature semaphore signals. Okay, and they often have coloured webbing between their toes to make the signal clearer. Now, there are two things you might guess. If somebody tells you about the existence of the ubiquity of leg-waving frogs on three continents, you might say to yourself, well, I tell you what, that I've always thought when I'm walking past the pond at night that while that frog may be really good at attracting lady frogs, it's also really good at giving away its position. So maybe what these frogs are doing is finding a way of signaling to their conspecifics that doesn't attract predators. There's been selection for being silent. This is a really good signal because it's a silent signal, and there's been selection for it being silent. Or you might say to yourself, you know, the great thing about that leg waving is that it doesn't matter how much background noise there is, doesn't matter how noisy the environment is, you can still see the leg waving. So we might say that's the leg waving is a noise-proof signal. So maybe there's been selection for being detected against background noise, and there's been selection for being noise-proof. Now, I take it that those are straightforward causal stories. So the first story says the reason there are a lot of leg-waving frogs is because if you don't make a noise, the predators don't find you and eat you, and if you don't get eaten, you have more babies. And the second one says the reason there are a lot of leg-waving frogs is that if nobody can hear you, in hell, nobody can hear you croak or something. I don't know, whatever it is. If nobody can hear you croak, then you're not going to get any mates. People are going to come invading your territory. There are going to be lots of fights. So you need a signal that can be heard when there's a high level of background noise, so you change to a visual signal. So what the good thing about this is that you're able to send signals, which means you're able to get mates and you're able to defend your territory and so forth. Now, of course, I already knew what the answer was. There's a big literature on leg-waving frogs. Leg-waving frogs have evolved in parallel evolution many, many times from many different genuses of frogs. They always evolve in species which are specialists inhabiting the areas around waterfalls in fast-flowing streams. Okay? Therefore, it is universally accepted in the scientific literature that there was selection for being noise-proof and no selection for being silent. Okay? Now, here's the point I want to make. We've got two selection scenarios. They're both straightforward causal stories about how the aggregation of events of getting eaten and getting laid produced population frequencies at a later stage. Okay? Totally unproblematic. Is there a fact of the matter as to which one is true? Damn right there is. There's a causal story about why these guys had babies, and it's either this way or that way. However, there's another possibility. Both stories could be true, and both kinds of causal effects could have been really operative in history. And if that occurred, we'd get what I call causal composition. We could meaningfully say to what extent was the rise of leg waving in the frog population produced by the superior efficiency in avoiding predation, and to what extent was it produced by the superior efficiency in being detected against the running water noises. And we could build a model in which we say, well, how long would it still have gone to fixation if it was only the selection for being silent operating and not the selection for being noise proof, or vice versa? We can partition, literally, the strength of selection to these two forces. So it seems to me that when the selection of selection for distinction is being used in the right context, it's simply asking which of the properties of these frogs enters into a causal generalization which explains their reproductive success. Okay? And because that's what you're asking, the competing properties should pass the causal composition test. If they're both true, then their results add up to a total effect. One of them might be more or less important. It could even change over time. You might argue that the trait initially spread because of being silent, but then that ceased to be important because that particular predator died out or whatever it was, and these guys then... So that it was maintained in existence only by being noise-proof, something like that. And I take that to be just a complex statistical aggregate of a lot of really boring facts about frogs getting laid and getting eaten. There's nothing weird, nothing semantic going on there. Okay. So what I want to do now is contrast that to other ways you can use the distinction. So I would say that selection of selection four, you need properties that are genuine causal competitors and which pass the causal composition test. What I think people go wrong, first place they go wrong, is by applying it to properties that relate as role and realizer. So, little example, was hemoglobin selected because it binds oxygen or because it contains iron? Okay. What I want to point out is that there are not two different selection scenarios. In one selection scenario, there was this molecule around which was really good at binding iron. And you think that historically it was really good at containing iron. Because it contains so much iron, that's why it was selected. Then there's a competing causal story. No, that wasn't what made this animal have babies. What made this animal have so many babies was that it had a molecule which had a high affinity with oxygen, and it was able to circulate that molecule in its circulatory system. Now, it's not that those two properties can't come apart. They're, you know, intrinsically linked. Some crazy proportion of life on Earth doesn't use hemoglobin. There are two other, one I know is hemocyanins, but there's another one as well, right? So crustaceans, lots and lots of marine arthropods. What's that?
But they all use iron.
No, I thought hemocyanin has copper as the respiratory carrier. Pretty sure it does. But anyway.
I only interrupt because I use the same thing.
So the point is, they're not the same property. One of them, in fact, is a realized... There's a property of being good at binding oxygen, and that's realized by various different chemical properties that different carrier molecules have. Okay? So if you say, was it selected for one or for the other, the right answer is it was selected for both, but that answer fails the causal composition test. Hemoglobin was selected because it binds oxygen, you're not then saying, oh, well, if it had only been made of iron and not bound oxygen, that would have been a different selection scenario. Different forces would have been operating. Okay, what you're doing is you're saying it was selected because it filled this role, and it filled that role by having this realizer. Okay, now I think the ultimate example of getting that wrong, how do those two relate? I take it, by the way, that these different levels of explanation relate in very much the manner of what Frank Jackson, Philip Pettit, and various other people have called contrastive and comparative explanations. So the higher level explanation, the explanation in terms of binding oxygen, it's a comparative explanation because it groups the particular causal scenario with all of the other causal scenarios in which the same outcome would occur. So it groups hemoglobin with hemocyanin, right? Whereas it was selected because it contains iron, you're talking about it's a contrastive explanation where you take the cases in which different outcomes occur and ask what was the factor that made this one different from that contrast class. So in this case, it's containing iron as opposed to not containing iron, or look at variant hemoglobin molecules which have different binding efficiencies, right? It's this one, it's slightly more efficient. Why don't we all circulate fetal hemoglobin? There's a good reason for that. It's not as good for the job in the adult as it is in the fetus, right? Okay, so I take it that those are completely compatible explanations. They fail the causal composition test. And as far as I can see, you shouldn't apply the selection of selection for distinction in that context. It's simply not meaningful. Why do we think it's meaningful? So, I mean, the first time I came up with that example, I thought, oh yeah, you can say I thought to myself, maybe you can say there's been selection for binding oxygen, but only selection of containing iron. Now, why did that seem to make sense? Seems to me there's a way of using the language of selection of and selection for. You have multiple levels of explanation. If they're all good explanations, they're complementary explanations, and they're going to relate using the comparative contrastive distinction or some other philosopher's apparatus for dealing with similar cases. Okay? On the other hand, suppose you've got multiple levels of explanation, and you think that at one level of explanation, there really isn't a good explanation to be had. Okay? There just isn't a good explanation at that level. There's stuff going on, right? But it's not really doing any explaining. You can use the selection of selection for distinction to say there's a good explanation at this level, but there's no good explanation at that level. There isn't a good counterfactual supporting story to be told at that level. The only point I want to make about it, I don't particularly want to get into the legitimacy of that. The point I want to make about that is that is completely different from what's happening in the core instance where you take alternative selection scenarios. So if you use selection of selection for in both ways, you're using it ambiguously to mean there are two possible causal scenarios which, if they were both true, would be causal competitors. And I'm telling you that one of them has had the dominant or the unique influence in the actual causal history. And then you're using exactly the same words on the next page to mean in a multi-level analysis of a particular chunk of nature, I think the valid explanatory narratives are all at this level and there aren't any at that level, which is something, an utterly unrelated topic. So at the very least, if we wanted to make this distinction, We ought to use a completely different set of language for it and recognize that we're not talking about the same thing that we started with at all. Finally, the other thing which I think is, from a biological point of view, slightly bizarre, is using selection of, selection for distinction to distinguish between co-referring descriptions, which I think is something we've seen a lot of in the teleosemantics literature. So, for example, if somebody says, well, I agree that there was selection for being noise-proof in those frogs, but there was only selection of having the property that Paul's been going on about for the last 10 minutes. Okay. That seems to me to be utterly devoid of biological interest and a complete, you know, waste of time, even as an issue to talk about. I mean, you know, we all know this stuff. Read that second sentence, de re, and it'll be the same as the first one. Read it, de dicto, and it won't. This has got nothing to do with biology. It's not interesting. So what I'm proposing is that the selection of, selection for distinction should be strictly restricted to its use to discriminate as a matter of historical fact between causally competing, between the focal properties in multiple causally competing selection scenarios. That's where it's only kind of meaningful biological use. Okay, that's the only way we should use it. And that's how I'm going to use it. My claim is that in that sense, it's unproblematic, you need it, and I'm going to use it in the rest of the talk. So what I want to talk about is selection for truth. So what I'm going to try and show you is that it's plausible that the dominant selection, historical selection scenario in the evolution of cognition is selection for truth tracking, for the generation of veridical representations of reality. Okay, point I've been trying to make is that contrasting fitness tracking and truth tracking is utterly biologically meaningless. I think, I'm not sure it ever makes sense to contrast any other kind of selection for to selection for fitness. To say something's been selected for fitness is, after all, to say that it's been selected with some additional words added. Okay? What's the alternative? If somebody says, was of any trait, was that trait selected for some substantial role, or was it selected for being fit? And you apply Sober's standard test, you say, oh, well, suppose it had lacked the substantial property, but it had still increased your fitness, would it have been selected? And the answer will always be yes, by definition. And then you say, well, suppose it had not been fit, but still had all of its other properties, would it have been selected? The answer will always be no, by definition. Okay? So it seems to me that it's utterly meaningless to use the selection of, selection for distinction to contrast the property of having a particular fitness function with any of the realizer properties of having that fitness function. Don't see how that could mean anything in a biological sense. Okay, so truth tracking, I want to argue, is nothing weird. Truth tracking is a rather vague ecological property. It's very comparable to, say, foraging efficiency. So I've got two organisms, and I say, why is this organism common and that one only found in a few, you know, refuges up high in the Alps where nobody ever gets to go there apart from it, and its population is decreasing anyway. And I say, well, it's because this variant down here is a really efficient forager, and that guy up there is a lousy forager. You know, it spends ages at patches that any blind Freddy could see are exhausted of any resources and starves to death and stuff like that. It's a really bad forager. These guys are really efficient foragers. You apply optimal foraging theory and they look as if they were designed by a mad dog adaptationist. Okay, that's why they did so well. And I think that's strictly comparable if you've got one organism which is a radical counterinductivist and it's rare, and another organism that's a fairly naive but effective inductivist and it's common. And you say, why is one organism rare and the other one common? I would say, because this organism is better at tracking truth than that one. This one's really bad at forming veridical representations. That one's much better at it. So I just think it's a straightforward ecological property. If cognition was not selected for truth tracking, it must have been selected for a causal competitor property which features in another selection scenario. So to deny that cognition was selected for truth tracking, you can't say because it was selected for fitness. That's literally, I think, meaningless. Okay? It's a silly thing to say. You have to say, oh, well, no, it was selected for, our large brain is primarily there to cool the blood, and the fact that it does cognition is a side effect. That would be a real, if implausible, hypothesis. Okay, so historically, the fact that people formed veridical representations is side effect, and the reason that there was exponential growth in human brain size was that it became more and more important to cool the blood. Okay. Now, if you look at Alvin Plantinga's so-called alternative Darwinian hypotheses to explain the existence of a large human brain and are engaging in vast amounts of expensive cognition, they are all actually real causal competitors, but they're all absurdly biologically implausible. The claim that there's exponential growth in human brain size was driven by genetic linkage to other alleles. I mean, that there is, you know, that is a genuine hypothesis. It's just demonstrably wrong. Okay, look at the genetics. It's just, it's not even a starter. The claim that, I won't go through, but anyway, Plantinga basically comes up with some not very well thought through evolutionary speculations about why we might devote 20% of our energy budget to running a big brain. Okay, and they're genuine causal competitors, but I don't think they're anything anybody would worry about. Okay, it's actually quite hard to come up with a property other than veridically representing the environment and driving, if pragmatically effective, action to be the core. It's like, imagine somebody said, I'm going to come up with an alternative explanation about the evolution of the digestive tract and its various ancillary organs, in which ingesting food and processing it to get energy doesn't play a significant role. That's a really hard thing to do. You could probably do it. But I mean, you know, this is a Tolkien-level lifetime science fiction project to come up with an alternative story about everything from the simple guts of annelid worms to the function of the appendix without that business about eating stuff, digesting them, and extracting energy having a significant role in it. Okay? It's hard. Well, I think giving a story about the evolution of cognition in which veridical representation doesn't play a key role is an equally hard problem. So let me talk about a couple of reasons why somebody might deny what I'm suggesting is actually rather clear. I want to think about it this way. What would cognition look like if it was selected solely for truth tracking? Okay? What would cognition look like if it was selected solely for truth tracking? And drawing on Orszag and Sober's work, I'm going to work with this idea that what is the optimal phenotype? The optimal phenotype is one that would be predicted by a model from which everything other than natural selection has been removed. So if we assume that there's unlimited variation in all directions, if we assume that nothing is developmentally impossible, if we assume that it all happened in huge populations over long periods of time with continuous selection in one direction and so on and so forth, right? So there's absolutely nothing going on other than natural selection. What would you see? And what I want to suggest is that the model of... So when people notice things about cognition and say, oh, look, that suggests that this is not an optimally evolutionarily designed system for tracking truth, that's because they've got the wrong idea about what an optimally designed cognitive system for tracking truth would look like. So what I'm going to give you is an account of what it is to be optimally designed for truth tracking, which looks surprisingly like the limited and fallible kinds of cognition that we know we and other animals are capable of. All right? Is that's clear where I'm trying to go with this? Okay, so what I'll argue is it's not unconstrained optimum. There are two... These are the two important ones which will do a lot of work. Two unavoidable constraints. There are two ways in which the optimal phenotype is always going to be constrained. And if you lose these constraints, you don't get something more optimal. You get no hypothesis whatever. Okay? One is cost constraints. So if somebody says to me, look, I've worked out that if antelopes didn't bother to build any other part of their body and never did anything, and they didn't have an immune system and stuff like that, they'd actually be able to have bigger, stronger legs and run faster. Doesn't that show that selection is not solely for the efficiency of their gait, that their legs are not actually optimally designed for moving? Because look, if they had, you know, no immune system, they could have bigger muscles there. Okay? That's not a relevant consideration. Something is optimally to be optimally designed is not to be unconstrained by cost. Otherwise, we get this nice quote from John Maynard Smith. All selection processes are constrained, or else organisms, as Maynard Smith said, would live forever, would lay eggs at an infinite rate, would be impregnable to predators, and so on and so forth. Okay? So to be optimally designed cannot be to be designed without cost constraints. The reason I've got that little guy on the right, the brown antechinus, which is a group of small Australian mammals, is because the antechinus is a really good example of how tightly constrained animals are by cost, something which we're inclined at an intuitive level to overlook because we all live under in a temporary period of massive abundance in which we're frankly not very constrained by cost. But most animals are very constrained by cost a lot of the time. Antechinuses are really cool because once a year the mating season arrives and they copulate wildly for 1 to 2 weeks and then all of the males die. It's called a Big Bang mating strategy. Why do they die? They die because they transfer all of their physiological resources from tissue maintenance to sperm production and to energy and competition. Okay, so they don't bother to repair anything, they don't bother to make antibodies, their immune system collapses during this period. And so they basically just put every calorie in their body into fighting, well, the three Fs, as Sterone likes to call it, fighting, fleeing, and copulation. Then they die. In some species, the females die shortly after having their babies as well, which is kind of interesting. So why do they do that? Well, standard life history theory says this is a response to an ecology in which the probability of surviving to a second breeding season is close to zero and there's no parental care. So when a male has fertilized as many females as it can, there is nothing it can do to promote its fitness from that point on. It's just waiting for death. So it makes no sense whatever to maintain its body or to, you know, save anything up for after the last little event. It should just use it all up and die. Okay. Now, imagine that these guys spent 20% of their energy budget on things like philosophy of biology, quantum mechanics, engineering, okay? You can bet your bottom dollar that about a week or so before the breeding season, their cortex would start to regress, okay? In the same way that, you know, where you get, you know, in the nuclei, of, you get in birds' brains where whole areas will regress just before the migration season, just basically liquefy it, get rid of that bit. These guys would just give up on quantum mechanics once a year, I can guarantee it. Okay? So every time you do any cognition, what you're doing is trading sperm production, the strength of your immune system, repairing, you know, killing off cells to replacing them to avoid cancer and all that kind of stuff. You do standard life history trade-offs. So what would be an optimally designed cognitive system would not spend a calorie more on cognition than could be justified by the cost of calories priced in all of the other activities they could be devoted to. So if you look at the fitness value of making another 3,000 sperm versus adding another decimal point to your calculation of pi, you won't add another decimal point to the calculation of pi unless that's worth more to you in potential reproductive output than 3,000 sperm. So an optimally designed cognitive system will be cost-constrained. The main result of saying it's optimal is that you'll predict that it's close to a particular value of that. Saying it's less optimal will just let it wander around that. The basic point, yep, holds. Now, if we look at the literature that's often cited to show that we are not designed to get the right answer, of course, it's the heuristics and biases literature. It's Gigerenzer and Todd and all those guys. It's who's the Nobel Prize winner, the behavioral economics, you know.
Kahneman and Tversky.
Everybody cites, look, you know, we're not designed for getting it right. I don't think that shows that we're not evolutionarily optimally designed for getting it right. And this slogan is, let's just remember, heuristic is not a method for making errors. So if somebody says, look, this guy used a heuristic, they've been designed to make errors, I think that's misleading. The errors are the price you pay for getting it right on the other occasions. It's not the function of the heuristic to generate errors. So I think if you take a kind of standard, limited rationality perspective, the standard question, why are we using these limited heuristic methods? Because they're cheap and dirty. They get you as many good results as you want, and they do it cheaply. It's not worth investing more energy in taking it more carefully. Okay? So it seems to me that there's really no... The whole general thrust of the argument, look how sub-rational people are, therefore they're not designed for getting it right, is confused. Okay? To be designed to cost, to be cost-efficient and right reasonably often is the only kind of thing that an evolutionary optimum would look like. Okay? An evolutionary optimum is always going to be trading the cost of a bit more accuracy against errors. Okay, now the other kind of cost constraint is one which was, it's kind of obvious, there's actually an evolutionary psych literature on it, but the idea I came across clearly first time 20 years ago in a paper by Peter Godfrey Smith, the idea that the optimum response to certain cognitive tasks faces a standard trade-off between type 1 and type 2 errors, so there's no error-free solution, and any optimal solution is going to contain some errors. So this is the little picture from Peter's paper. I won't try to explain it properly. It's very straightforward. I mean, it's basically just saying we've got increasing values of a signal, strengths of signal up here. We've got the probability of two probability distributions here. This distribution here is the probability of getting a given signal strength as noise, and this distribution is the probability of getting given signal strength as signal. Okay? So that's the probability of getting signal strength X if the signal you're detecting is a veridical signal, and this distribution here, measured on that same scale, is the probability of getting a signal strength X if that signal is noise. Okay? And so what you basically got is the longer you wait, the less likely it is to be noise, and the more likely it is to be signal. Okay? The optimal value, XC, is given by just calculating from a standard payoff matrix. We've got four possible things. It's a veridical signal, and you act on it. It's a veridical signal, you don't act on it. It's noise and you act on it. It's noise and you don't act on it. And the relative value of these four options plus these probability distributions is going to determine this optimal value. Now, I don't want to make too much of that because it's a little tiny, Mickey Mouse case. I just want to get across the general point that basically organisms are continually making decisions under uncertainty. Okay? Rabbits do not achieve Cartesian certainty about the presence of predators, and that's a very good thing. So you're often going to be the evolutionarily optimal response will be one which generates a predictable rate of balance of type 1, type 2 errors. The right number of type 1 and type 2 errors is undefined unless you attach values to them. Okay, so there's in fact no definition of what is the optimum cognitive phenotype that doesn't include the relative price of the different kinds of error. So forget the little simple model. The general point is organisms are continually having to make decisions with less than perfect information. The optimal response is always going to be a response that depends on the value of different kinds of error. Okay? And just to quote, nice quote from Peter, unless you ask about what's happening in the real world, you can't put numbers in these boxes. I mean, the reason that... So in this diagram, you're not showing the representation relation between what's going on in the mind and the way the real world is. But that relation's there in the background because you can't put anything in these boxes without looking at whether or not the animal is responding. If you act as if the world is a given way and it is not that way, you end up over here. If you act as if the world is a given way and it is that way, you end up over here. So the world's being a particular way is an essential part of the story. And that's Peter's quote, which I use to sort of sum that up. He says, correspondence truth has a definite place. If C is regard, C, the optimal value, sorry, the response driven by that, is regarded as representing S. Hits and rejections are truths. Misses and false alarms are errors. Truth remains a definite goal of cognition. Okay? So what I want to suggest is roughly this. If cognition were solely designed for tracking truth, it would be cost constrained, it would face intrinsic task constraints, and this is the only sensible definition of an evolutionarily optimal truth-tracking cognitive system. Organisms represent optimally if they obtain as much relevant truth, that's where price comes in, as much relevant truth as they can afford and tolerate no more error than is needed to obtain it. Okay? So if you think that an optimally designed cognitive system where selection was solely selection for truth tracking, for veridical representation, is captured by that definition of optimality, what I want to put to you is that it's plausible that for large domains of cognitive activity, we're pretty well designed. The large domains of cognitive activity, we and all other animals are pretty well designed. So if you're, for example, we look at the red-tailed hawks hunting in the countryside around here, and somebody says, a priori, do you think it's reasonable to think that when the red-tailed hawks are looking for prey around them, that they get it right, they get the things that are significant to their lives correct quite a lot, and when they get it wrong, it's only because they're trading being a little, you don't waste that much energy stooping with a small probability there's no rabbit there. Okay, it's well worth having a shot. So when they get it wrong, that's the only way to get it wrong less often would be to get it right less often on other occasions, and that trade-off is worth their while. I think that's a very plausible view of the evolution of cognitive apparatus of a red-tailed hawk. And it's for certain major domains, it's a very plausible view about the evolution of our own cognition. So what major domains are those? I'm inclined to identify it with good old Mauryan common sense. Now, of course, that word's been used in many different ways for 100 years in an interesting philosophical literature. But if you go back and read A Defense of Common Sense, what does Moore actually include as his examples of the common sense truth? They are the existence of middle-sized physical objects around us, their spatiotemporal location, and the things that are contemporary and we tend to refer to fashionably today as theory of mind. Okay, so if you look at what Moore actually gives us as examples, it's, chairs, mantelpiece, the mantelpiece is to the right of the chair, things, this is 4 meters away, I have a mind, I want stuff, I like stuff, I think stuff, that thing over there is another person, it wants stuff and thinks stuff too, and it knows that about me. Okay, now I think it's reasonably plausible that human beings are It's as plausible that human beings are optimally designed in this sense for knowing Mauryan common sense facts as it is that our gait is optimally designed for a traditional human lifestyle on a similar definition of optimality, or that our digestive system is optimally designed for eating the kind of omnivorous diet that human beings have traditionally eaten on a similar definition of optimality. I don't see any substantial reason for thinking that our ability to know Mauryan common sense truths is any less optimal in this sense than our ability to walk and run, our ability to digest stuff, our ability to get laid. All right? Other basic ecological roles. Okay, so I'm not impressed by that case. Now, I want to confront the other issue. How long do I have? Not long. Did we start 5 minutes late?
About 10 minutes.
Oh, great, that's fine. That case I have plenty of time. 15, not a problem. Good. So, 5 would have been a problem. Okay. What I want to do now is look at this idea that one of the problems here is having an inflated conception of truth. When you look at Plantinga, I mean, there's a lot in Plantinga stuff, but Plantinga has some interesting sort of stories about how, well, I could have this kind of conceptual scheme that doesn't tell it like it is, but is sort of complexly mirroring the real story about how it is, so that everything I believe is false, but my actions are all correct, right? Now, one of the things I think that's going on there is an extremely strong notion of what it is to have a true belief. As somebody looks at this from a fundamentally evolutionary naturalistic perspective, I was in the bush with some philosophers a few weeks ago in an ludicrously leech-ridden part of Australia. The trail was completely covered in two species of leeches. And they're all standing up. We have dry leeches, Canada and places, I believe they all live in lakes. I haven't experienced that particular horror. In our case, they crawl on the ground. And the entire ground is covered in leeches. They're on 1 foot stuck on the rock or something, sniffing the air, going round and round, sniffing. And then when they, you know, detect they're close enough, they come towards you like one of those slinky toys and try to get up your boots, and often succeed. Those guys live in an incredibly simple world. They're detecting a couple of different chemical parameters and driving all of their behavior off it and just sort of climbing up chemical gradients. Okay? I mean, their sensory world is incredibly simple. It seems to me the idea that leeches do not successfully represent the world and tell it how it is, get it right. Okay, so the leech basically thinks there's a mammal here now. Of course, I'm not suggesting we should apply rich semantic categories. I'm just trying to say we can make sense of the idea that the leech judges mammal here now and that it judges correctly. It gets it right, it tells it like it is. Even though what's going in for mammal there is a ludicrously impoverished view of what the world is like. Okay? What I'm going to argue is that we should accept that much of what we think of as straightforwardly true has no more to recommend it than the world of the leech, and is nevertheless straightforwardly true. We should recognize that we're, much of the time, the only difference between us and leeches is a few dimensions of cognitive complexity. In terms of telling it like it is, we're doing telling it like it is in no more deep sense than the leech is, and we should be completely cool with that. I know it isn't very clear. I'll expand on that in the last part of my talk. So it's very easy for Darwinists to fall into the view that because we are merely evolved animals, the universe is beyond our capacity to grasp the real truth. So here's Darwin. He's writing about philosophy and metaphysics. And about metaphysics, he says, "I feel most deeply the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton." So I do find a lovely image. So there's some, little English, spaniel, Charles II spaniel or something, looking at Sir Isaac and, thinking, "I wonder what he's doing," scribbling. "I wonder if he's trying to get laid. I wonder if there's some way that he can get meat doing that," He's just not going to get it. Doesn't matter how long the dog thinks about it, he's not going to get it. And roughly, that's what Darwin thought about much of the activity of 19th century metaphysics. And equally a waste of time. Here's Haldane, which I really, the lovely Haldane quote you probably all know. "My suspicion is the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose." Now, I think those are nice, witty remarks, but there's something fundamentally wrong with them, or at least if you read the Darwin, what he actually says is quite sensible, but taken on its own, that remark. And I think Haldane's making a mistake. The mistake is in thinking that if we are possessed of an incredibly limited worldview, and constrained, even if we're constrained within that worldview by our physical constitution, that therefore we never get to believe anything true. If you take that idea seriously, okay, I mean, we know that our, let me move on. I mean, I think that's just an idea that is not an option. Talk about the other two guys in a minute. I just want to take you back to another quote you all know, the famous Eddington Two Tables quote. So this is Eddington basically saying, contemporary physics in my day, as he says, right? So the table is solid. And he says, Notwithstanding its strange construction, it is an entirely efficient table. If I lean on the table, I shall not go through. Or to be strictly accurate, the chance of my scientific elbow going through my scientific table is so excessively small that it can be neglected in practical life. Okay? So Eddington's basically contrasting, you know, the common sense image of the world and the scientific image. Here's the point I want to make, that there is a very, I think in the last 20 odd years in philosophy, most people have come to think that it's fundamentally naive to respond to a story like that by saying there are no tables. Okay, I remember I read a popular science book many years ago now, 10, 12 years ago, where the author, who obviously hadn't done any philosophy, had rediscovered the existence of secondary qualities. And he was explaining the existence of secondary qualities to his popular science audience. And he said, science has discovered that the fact that things have that there are colors is an illusion foisted on us by our selfish genes to aid our reproduction. Okay, and I remember thinking, you know, damn, you know, this is why first-year philosophy courses should be compulsory. All right? Green is not what you thought it was, but the conclusion that therefore everybody who says that's green is speaking in error is one that I think we have spent 300 years rejecting, and quite rightly. Okay. So, similarly, we should reject the view that there are no tables. On the other hand, you have to recognize that when we say there are tables and they're colored green, we're saying something incredibly parochial. Another example I like here, which I've used in the paper, if I take out a field guide to the birds, it would be a very silly person who came along and said, look, that doesn't show any of the color patterns the birds are seeing in the UV. That book is full of falsehoods. All right? This field guide is a vile, misleading document. It shows you all these, shows these two little birds that are absolutely identical, whereas in fact they're completely sexually dimorphic in bird colors. Okay, it's silly to say that the field guide is full of falsehoods. The field guide accurately represents how birds appear to human beings, and it's also really useful to know how birds appear to birds, but there's no problem here, right? So the idea that's being introduced there is von Uxkull's idea of the Umwelt. So what I want to suggest is that just as we can make sense of the leech judging correctly in the Umwelt of the leech, and the bird judging colors correctly in the Umwelt of the bird, and we need to do that if we're going to understand either leeches or birds, which is von Uxkull's point, we should think about Eddington's everyday table, familiar to him from his youth, as an object that exists in the Umwelt of Homo sapiens. So the world of common sense stands in the same relation to us that the Umwelt of the leech stands to the leech. It represents the world in terms of the evolved categories and capacities of the human mind. And what I want to insist is that there's no problem with saying of an animal that even within a very limited Umwelt, that animal has judged correctly how the world is, that it's veridically represented things. An example I think brings this home quite nicely, another favorite example of mine. It's not the sort of thing people write about these days. So von Uxkull, of course, the concept of the Umwelt has had a very bad press recently because it's been taken up in sort of literary theory and things. In its original context, concept of an Umwelt is completely respectable. Tim Bergen and Lorenz and all of those early guys, perfectly happy with the idea of an Umwelt. We don't use the word very much, but anybody in animal behavior still knows that one of the critical things you need to understand about the animal is how is it representing the world? What are the perceptual and conceptual categories in which the world presents itself to the animal? Nod to Brian there, right? If you don't understand the perceptual and conceptual categories in which the world presents itself to the animal, you can have incredible trouble making any sense of the animal's behavior. Now, in a very famous and great paper, his first paper translated into English, Conrad Lorenz wrote a paper called The Companion in the Umwelt of the Bird, 1935. He described the Umwelt of mainly the hooded crows he was working with. And it, you know, talk about gavagai and rabbit slices. According to Lorenz, in the Umwelt of the hooded crow, there are no crows. There are no animals are not represented as continuing individuals. There's this crow, and it does stuff. Instead, there are stimulus arrays linked to particular patterns of behavior. So a flocking companion arrives, And the very same bird later on is a sexual companion. But the idea of it being the same bird is not part of the Umwelt of the Hooded Crow, according to Lawrence. Okay? So the world is divided into stimulus arrays linked to particular bodies of instinctive behavior. And it consists of, and I believe the German word works better than the English here, it consists not of individual animals, but these things that Lorenz calls companions. So there's not a flock of birds. Instead, there are many flocking companions, many sexual companions, many parenting companions, so forth. Okay. Now, it doesn't really matter whether Lorenz is right about that. The point is that it's a respectable scientific hypothesis. He might be right about that. And that's a completely different world from the human Umwelt. What I want to suggest is that it's crazy to say there's anything wrong with it. To say that my claim that there are chairs in this room has some greater sense of being a veridical truth about reality than the crow's judgment that a sexual companion has just approached me. Both of those judgments are 100% correct. Okay? So, that's the claim. Now, what I want to claim is that if we put all these ideas together, we get a very deflated... So what I want to say that there's been evolution is selected for truth, what I'm trying to argue is that in something like a domain of Mooreian common sense, in which what I mean by truth is judging correctly the contents of our Umwelt, that our cognitive faculties conform to something like that definition of optimality that I gave you earlier. And in that sense, I want to argue that it's very plausible that the dominant selection pressure in the development of human and other animals' cognition has been selection for truth.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.